This is VOA News via remote. I'm Liz Pelka. The U.S. Electoral College cast votes on Monday, formally handing the 2020 presidential election to former Vice President Joe Biden. As expected, President-elect Biden obtained 306 electoral votes when 270 were needed to win the presidency. The Electoral College vote is normally a routine formality on the U.S. presidential election calendar, happening every 4 years. But since the November 3rd national vote, President Trump has repeatedly claimed without credible evidence that the vote in key battleground states was fraudulent, costing him the election. The president and his allies have lost more than 50 lawsuits in battleground states contesting the vote. President-elect Biden spoke in a televised primetime address Monday evening after the Electoral College results were finalized. He brought up the threats of violence local election officials and workers endured while ensuring democracy prevailed during the election and the recounts. The president-elect called the threats unconscionable and said the workers showed courage and commitment. It's an optimistic day as the first people receive the coronavirus vaccine in the U.S. But it's also a day the country saw yet another devastating milestone become a reality during the pandemic. 300,000 dead in the United States. Data updated by Johns Hopkins University showed the U.S. surpassed that grim 300,000 mark. While it took 4 months for the first 100,000 Americans to succumb to the virus, some public health experts forecast another 100,000 deaths before the end of January. Similar surges are being recorded around the world. This is VOA News. Travel-related stocks in Japan slid on Tuesday after Prime Minister Yoshihide Suga said a travel subsidy program would be suspended nationwide. The suspension is to help contain the surge in cases of the novel coronavirus. At a coronavirus meeting held on Monday, Suga said he would temporarily halt the program from December 28th to January 11th. The measure comes at a time when Japan has witnessed a spike in COVID-19 infections. The country reported a record of more than 3,000 new daily cases on Saturday, and its capital, Tokyo, confirmed 621 new cases. U.S. stocks ended mostly lower on Wall Street on Monday, this after an early rally disappeared. Investors are waiting to see if Congress can pull through on delivering more coronavirus aid to American people, businesses, and local governments. Meanwhile, in Europe, talks continue on trying to reach a trade deal between Britain and the European Union. A bipartisan group of U.S. lawmakers has unveiled a proposal for COVID-19 relief as Congress searches for a final agreement. The proposal released Monday includes billions of dollars for businesses, the unemployed, and for schools, along with money for vaccine distribution. But the path forward is unclear. Congressional leaders and Trump administration officials are trying to negotiate a final solution to virus relief and government funding. There is hope for a midnight deadline Friday to deliver a completed package to President Donald Trump. Ethiopia sent civil servants in Tigray back to work on Monday. The government also ordered gun owners to disarm as part of Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed's efforts to restore normalcy in the northern region after weeks of war. Some power and telephone links were also restored in the regional capital after a communications blackout that started during federal troops' November 4th offensive. However, there were also reports of big fuel and food price hikes, water shortages, and accounts of hunger and harassment from refugees. Abiy has declared victory over the former local ruling party, the Tigray People's Liberation Front. The powerful TPLF dominated federal government for nearly three decades before anti-government protests propelled Abiy to office in 2018. International Criminal Court prosecutors said in a report Monday they will not investigate China for alleged genocide and crimes against humanity, this despite calls from exiled Uyghurs. You can read the full story on voanews.com as well as more international headlines. Via remote, I'm Liz Pelka, VOA News.
Morning Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, December 15, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The U.S. removes Sudan from the list of state sponsors of terrorism.
This is going to be the beginning of reincorporating Sudan into the global village and the international economy. It will open doors for lots of things. Bilateral relationship between Sudan and the U.S. This is big.
Southern African leaders meet to consider Mozambique crisis. The DRC releases a detained Zambian opposition politician. Nigerians march against government over the kidnapping of hundreds of schoolboys. And Uganda's Bobi Wine has a special message for the country's electoral commission.
All of us are going to the sheep to tell them that, look, I'm not the only candidate in this race. There's several others, including the incumbent. What's happening to me is happening to him too. So the next time you're calling me here, I want to appear with him too, because what you are accusing me for is happening to candidate Museveni too.
And Botswana announces new measures for travelers amid rising COVID-19 cases. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Sudanese are welcoming the decision by the United States to remove Sudan from the list of state sponsors of terrorism. U.S. Secretary of State Michael Pompeo announced the change on Monday. He said it was made possible by the efforts of Sudan's civilian-led transitional government to chart a bold new course away from the legacy of former President Omar al-Bashir's regime, and particularly to meet the statutory and policy criteria for the rescission. Bakri El-Meni is associate professor of business at Long Island University in New York.
Since 1993, Sudan has been on this list. It impacted everybody's life. I'm not even talking about the economy or the country. It's like literally, if you are a Sudanese, traveling on a Sudanese passport, the chances you will be put out of every single line and you will be scrutinized. And there are so many airways that wouldn't even allow you to fly on them if you need connection. So I'm so happy, so elated that young people in Sudan don't have to live with this burden anymore. This is going to be a beginning of reincorporating Sudan into the global village and the international economy. It will open doors for lots of things, bilateral relationship between Sudan and the U.S. There will be opportunities for the exchange of students going and studying in other countries. This is big. This is a really, really an important day, and I'm just grateful that one of those few things that we spent years trying to do something about it, but it was hard to do anything before the regime change in Sudan.
In his statement, Secretary Pompeo says that this was made possible by the efforts of Sudan's civilian-led transitional government to chart a bold new course away from the legacy of the Bashir regime to meet the statutory and policy criteria for rescission. But some people say, was this a quid pro quo that Sudan had to do something in order for this to be lifted?
This has been a process in the making for over a year. So the U.S. made a specific proposal about what Sudan needs to do in order for the U.S. to consider removing Sudan from the state sponsored terrorism. That's very, very straightforward. So in terms of quid pro quo, of course, international relations doesn't function without having, you know, it's a world of interest. So I'm sure some of the discussion involved, doing things here and there. And I know there was a larger package of all of this negotiation was supposed to lead to a few things. One of them is pushing Sudan to normalize relationship with Israel. That's one of the things that the U.S. asked for. And Sudan did take some steps in normalizing relationship with Israel. The chair of the Supreme Council in Sudan met with Prime Minister Netanyahu in Abiy in Uganda. So that happened in March. And most recently, there have been conversations. So there is a process for even normalizing relationship with Israel. That's part of it. I don't think you could make the point that it's necessarily connected to that issue. I think Sudanese leaders were open to having to have a normal relationship with everybody in the region. And this step would have taken place either way, whether like Sudan normalized relationship with Israel or not, because Sudan did not normalize relationship with Israel. There are some conversations happening right now. It came as a result of those sacrifices made by Sudanese people in confronting Bashir, and almost at a time when nobody was paying attention to Sudan.
Did you say that the fact that Sudan was on this list was also impacting ordinary Sudanese in this country. I thought it was just government to government.
When a country is listed on the state-sponsored terrorism, that automatically means if you carry that passport of that specific country and you are crossing any international borders, it is easy for any country to treat you as a potential terrorist. Unfortunately, it's government to government, but government issued passports, right? Government also issue visas. Governments do determine who has the right to get in and get out. So every single Sudanese person, whether living in Sudan or outside of Sudan, let me just give you a few examples. Because of being on this list, Sudanese businesses were not allowed to do business. Like, you can't send money. Like, the simplest thing that you could do right now, you could pick up the phone and use the Western Union to send money to 174 countries. You can't do that to Sudan because our banking system was disconnected. No one wants to do business with Sudan because there is all suspicion about funding terrorism. There is suspicion about having the money be used for terrorist reasons.
Bakri El-Mani is Associate Professor of Business at Long Island University in New York. Leaders of the Southern African Development Community, SADC, met Monday in Mozambique's capital, Maputo, to again consider how to handle the issue of Islamist insurgency in Mozambique's oil-rich Cabo Delgado province. On Monday, the UN High Commission for Refugees said at least 40,000 people have fled the region. Zimbabwe President Emmerson Mnangagwa's spokesperson George Charama said Monday that SADC was moving closer to sending troops to Mozambique. Paul Magwana is the Secretary for Legal Affairs for Zimbabwe's ruling ZANU-PF party.
President Mnangagwa visited Mozambique in his capacity as a member of the Troika, as the former chairman of the Organ on Peace and Security. And as a former chairman of the Organ on Peace and Security, as a member of the Troika, they discuss security matters. And obviously the situation in Mozambique was of concern and still remains of concern to the members of SADC and the members of the Troika. So whatever comments he made, he did so in his capacity as a member of the Troika on peace and security. When he said that he would be able to send troops, he can only do so as a member of SADC. When SADC makes a decision to defend the territorial interests of Mozambique, then they can send troops to defend one another, but not as Zimbabwe, but only as a member of SADC.
The question is that, do you think that SADC has the capability to send troops to Mozambique?
Yes, it does. They've done so before. They've SADC member states have amalgamated their forces to defend one another, and they can do so. They've done so in the DRC, if you remember. SADC member states have sent troops to the DRC, and they've assisted one another in terms of defending the territorial integrity of member states. So this is exactly what they intend to do in Mozambique if the situation continues to deteriorate, and that is what the president has been talking about.
Some people say that perhaps the crisis in Mozambique is a political one, and maybe SADC should deal with it on a political level.
Yes, if the situation remains political, they engage at a political level. But as you know, any insurgency is also a military situation. So they can also intervene militarily if the situation continues to deteriorate. So it's both political and military.
That was Paul Magwana, Secretary for Legal Affairs for Zimbabwe's ruling ZANU-PF party. He was speaking with us from the capital, Harare. Ugandan opposition presidential candidate Robert Chakulai, popularly known as Bobi Wine, says the country's electoral commission should also invite President Yoweri Museveni to explain the large crowds of his supporters who follow him despite COVID-19 regulations in the country. Wine, who was summoned by the commission over his large crowds, believes the electoral commission is being selective. Joel Senyonyi is the spokesperson for Bobi Wine's National Unity Platform Party.
The Electoral Commission did invite our presidential candidate, Honorable Robert Chagulanyi Ssentamu Bobi Wine, to discuss a couple of issues. Of course, they've made allegations that he's going around flouting COVID regulations and so on. And we have made the point consistently. He does not invite people to come out in droves as they do. You know, his only crime is that he's popular. He's a popular candidate. He's magnetic. So wherever he goes, by the roadside, people stand with him and so on. But also, we are telling the EC to stop the double standard, because what's happening with Honorable Chagulanyi, it's happening to all the other candidates too. Just that his is you know, higher magnitude, in the sense that there's many more people coming out and so on. But the incumbent, President Museveni, has crowds of people that wait for him by the roadside. They are walking in processions. Today he had a procession in the western part of the country. Police does not shoot at them. Police does not, you know, arrest any of them. It actually just protects them and so on. And so we've been telling the Electoral Commission, can they summon President Museveni too? We are not going to allow the double standards. What's good for the goods should be good for the gander. So tomorrow, Honorable Chagula is going to the EC to tell them those same things that we told them today, that look, I'm not the only candidate in this race. There's several others, including the incumbent. What's happening to me is happening to him too. So the next time you're calling me here, I want to appear with him too, because what you are accusing me for, Honorable Chagula, that is happening to candidate Museveni too.
How likely do you think the commission will do exactly what the Honorable Bobby Wine is going to ask them, that is to summon President Museveni to come before them?
Well, I can't answer that for them, but if it does not happen, then we'll tell them to give our candidate a break as well, because if it's happening to the incumbent and several others, why are you persecuting my candidate? So if they cannot summon the incumbent too, then we'll tell them, please give our candidate a break.
Maybe the Election Commission is not aware that President Museveni is having mass rallies.
So they first told us that when we met them about 2 weeks ago, they said a number of them, for us, we are not on social media, so we don't know about these things. And we told them, wait a minute, you are the guys that came out and said much of the campaigning should happen on social media. So you're the superintendents of this whole process. What are you going to monitor if you're not, if you're saying you're not on social media? But it was an excuse, of course. So even today they said, look, we have not seen or received any evidence to show that candidate Museveni is also doing what you're doing. But good enough, we were prepared. So we went with evidence. We showed them images and all of that, and then they acted like they were unaware of what's going on. But they obviously are aware, because by the time they summon our candidates, because of what they see on social media and so on, so they know what's happening with the other candidates. They're only afraid because he is their appointing authority.
I was talking to the Uganda Editors Forum about the new guidelines for accreditation of the media. Does the Honorable have any comment on that?
Yes, as the party and, of course, our presidential candidates have been concerned too. We have spoken about this. The way the military is being treated, they are brutalizing them. A number of them are actually still nursing injuries in hospital. Their crime is they're exposing the brutality of the police and the military of the regime.
Joel Sunyanyi is a spokesperson for Ugandan opposition presidential candidate Bobby Wine's National Unity Platform Party. You are speaking with us from the capital, Kampala. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, December 15. Authorities in the Democratic Republic of Congo have released a detained Zambian politician and former vice president, Neville Mulba, leader of the opposition New Hope Movement for Multi-Party Democracy of Zambia, was held in the Lubumbashi Hotel since last week by Congolese authorities who were investigating his presence in the country. I reached Mr. Mulba just as he was released and on his way to the airport back to Zambia.
Well, I don't think I have the whole picture. I think it's going to take a while. I came here on a business trip with a business associate, and we were just waiting to go into another meeting when the lodge was surrounded by heavy security people. I don't know how many they were, armed soldiers with guns and machine guns, and I was told to follow them, and they bundled me in the vehicle and then brought me from Kolwezi to Lubumbashi. Then when we got here, they interviewed me for 5 hours, asking me questions about allegations that they had drawn up. And I answered those allegations. None of them was true. So it raised other suspicions as to what this thing was all about. But I had to wait until my answers were verified. And then they went to Kinshasa, and Kinshasa sent a message just about under an hour ago to release me and to say, please let the former vice president travel.
Dr. Mumba, the question is, so what were you doing in DRC in the first place?
Well, I came here because we submitting letters of intent for the business that we do to supply certain commodities to Katanga government and the Lualaba government. And that's why we came. And it was during that time that I think we don't know where it's coming from, whether it's coming from Zambia or it's from within here. where they, you know, raised allegations that had met with the former president here, which is not true. I didn't meet President Kabila, I didn't meet him. But for some reason, that's the information they had. And apparently, I think I just came at a time when there was a lot of political problems. I'm sure you're following. And so I believe I was caught in the crossfire. But I think after verification, they have found out that none of the things they were saying was true.
So you were released. Did the Zambian government intervene on your behalf for your release?
I don't know that, James. My phones were taken away until just about 50 minutes ago. I'm not sure what the Zambian government did. I cannot make a comment. It is possible they could have done something. But I know the members of our embassy here were not allowed to come and see me, which is very unusual. They were blocked from seeing me. So I don't know whether the government did anything, but I'm sure I'm going to find out by tomorrow. Well, I'm just so glad I'm going back home to see my wife and my children and be back to the campaign trail so that I start getting myself ready for next year's election. That's really what I'm concerned about right now.
Do you have a business deal or business going on in the DRC?
No, we were trying to work on an offer that had been given to us to supply something, so we came to discuss that. So I don't have any business going on here. It was going to be our first business deal if we had cut it, and I think we still will.
Have you had political differences with people in the DRC?
Absolutely not. I'm very close to the president of DRC. He's a colleague, he's a friend. That's why it was a bit confusing, because I've been with him at State House. You know, when he won, I was with him to pray with him, and we get on very well. So when he heard about this, he was a little bit shocked as well, but he did give instructions that nothing should be done to me. In fact, instead of being in the cells, in the jail or somewhere, they put me in the hotel room because the president didn't want anything to happen to me. I don't have any political differences with DRC, absolutely not.
Nevos Mwamba is president of the opposition New Hope Movement for Multi-Party Democracy in Zambia. He was speaking with us from the DRC capital, Kinshasa. Hundreds of Nigerians in northwestern Katsina State on Sunday held street protests calling for answers from authorities after gunmen abducted more than 300 schoolboys. The abductions Friday are the worst in Nigeria since 2014, when Boko Haram terrorists kidnapped 276 schoolgirls from northeastern Chibok. Nigerian security forces say they engaged in gun battles with the kidnappers, but are still searching for the missing students. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
In audio from a protester, Kankara Town residents are heard marching on the streets Sunday, chanting that the government is ineffective and demanding the rescue of the kidnapped schoolboys. Locals say gunmen on motorcycles Friday abducted over 300 students at Kankara's Government Science School for Boys in northwest Nigeria's Katsina State. Katsina authorities said security forces traded fire with the kidnappers in a nearby forest over the weekend, but were still searching for 333 missing students. Kankara resident Salihu Bamli says the town is still in shock.
On the Friday night, the people of Kankara Town have been witnessing a very, very, very sad thing, because around 10 o'clock p.m. in the night, the bandits were there shooting sporadically in the town. Before that, they moved on and went straight to the Kankara school.
The kidnappings occurred hours after President Muhammadu Buhari landed in Katsina, his home state, for a week-long visit. Katsina authorities immediately closed all schools, and Nigerian police announced a review of security for schools across the country. It's the worst kidnapping incident since Boko Haram terrorists in 2014 kidnapped 276 schoolgirls from the northeast town of Chibok. 112 Chibok schoolgirls are still missing and believed to be held by the Islamic militants. The kidnapping sparked the Bring Back Our Girls group, which blames Nigerian authorities for not doing enough to find the girls. The group's leader, Edith Yassin, says she fears the schoolboys taken Friday could be forced to join an armed group.
When such a large number of boys are taken away from a school, what immediately comes to mind is child soldiers, forced labor, and all other evil that terrorists make young people do. They're also looking maybe for a new crop of young people to indoctrinate.
Security experts note Boko Haram does not usually operate in northwest Nigeria, where bandits and kidnapping for ransom are more common. Kabir Adamu runs the private Beacon Security Group in Abuja. He says Nigeria's poor law enforcement and justice systems are to blame.
I can count several states where this type of incidences have happened. Zamfara, Kaduna, Lagos, Ogun, Yobe. Schools have been attacked, students have been taken away, and no form of accountability. So clearly, the deterrence element within the criminal justice system in Nigeria is next to zero.
On Nigerian social media, hashtags like Bring Back Our Boys have been trending since the schoolboys were kidnapped. As police and the military continue to search for the kidnapped children, religious groups called for a statewide prayer on Monday. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja.
Botswana, battling rising COVID-19 cases, has announced local travelers will be required to test for the virus to move within the country this festive season. However, citizens argue the cost of testing at around $50 is prohibitive. Kundise Dube reports from Habaroni.
Botswana is one of Africa's prime safari destinations, attracting about 2 million international visitors a year to see the Okavango Delta, a unique wetland, and Botswana's abundant wildlife. Travel restrictions triggered by the pandemic brought tourism to a halt for much of 2020. But like many other tourism industry players, safari lodge operator Ben Muhalakwe sees hope after Botswana's recent decision to allow chartered flights into prime tourist destinations.
We still have hope. We're looking forward to the beginning of next year. Hopefully our peak season, which usually starts in March, should bring in some positivity with it, and hoping that everything normalizes, everything gets back to normal.
Some tourism and hospitality workers like Grace Rokoro are now jobless.
For the moment, I don't have a hope because I think there's still going to be a big challenge for the freelancers to be called to go and help, because they still have those staff. They have been staying home for a long.
Her husband, Chibia Longwani, owns a homemade canoe and used to provide rides to international tourists.
We work with other lodges, which give us business. If yes, they're going to get some guests coming, we hope we're going to deserve to have a big smile.
Minister of Environment, Natural Resources, Conservation and Tourism, Permanent Secretary Oduwezu Koboto, says the sector is showing signs of recovery.
We have also seen some recovery in the international market, especially after the government started opening up for direct flights, charter flights.
Tourism is Botswana's second largest foreign currency earner and contributes 13% to the Southern African country's gross domestic product. Mkondisi Dube for VOA News, Kasane, Botswana.
And that's it for this Tuesday, December 15th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing that you will have a great day.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, afrobeat to ndombolo and makosa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.
Hello, I'm Douglas Simpoga, host of VOA's Reporters Roundtable. Join us every Thursday as we discuss important African topics and events. I'll have a panel of African journalists and expert guests to discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important African news topics. That's Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.